Well, we're going to take you on a little tour this afternoon, or part of a tour. You only get half of the tour today, maybe you'll get the other half tomorrow, but we're going to start in the north, and you remember the biblical dimensions of the Holy Land. Actually, Israel's a fairly small country. It was in ancient times, it is today. And so there's the story of the Jewish tourist from New York City who arrived back from his tour of the Holy Land. And he said to his friend, Abi, I went to tour the Holy Land. And his friend said, what did you do in the afternoon? It's a country about the size of Rhode Island. So geographically, you'd say, really, it's not of very much importance. But theologically, it's of great importance, because this is the place where God settled his people. And he settled them, although it was a small country, he settled them in a very strategic location. There was a man who taught at the University of Chicago. His name was James Henry Breasted. Some of you might have seen his books. Another famous man. And he is the man who coined the term the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent, which has the fertile plain of Mesopotamia at one end and the fertile Nile Valley at the other end. Of course, at the seminary, they refer to Hillcrest Avenue as the Fertile Crescent. So here's this little postage stamp-sized country put in the middle, in between these great nations. And God put them there for a purpose. He put them there so that he could be a witness. They could be a witness to the nations round about. And they were to some extent. But to some extent, they failed in their challenge. And so altogether too often, their witness to the nations round about was not a very good witness. So we have this little country, and the biblical measurements are from Dan to Beersheba. And so we're going to start at Dan, and this is the sign that you see as you enter the archaeological area of excavations at Tel Dan. Tel Dan is at the foot of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is a very tall mountain, 9,000 feet. And around on the east side of Mount Hermon is Damascus. And then you come around the south to the west and you come to Tel Dan. And so this is right on the northern border. And you may remember the story of the fact that the tribe of Dan didn't originally settle at Dan. It was originally assigned some territory down near the coast, down near Tel Aviv, in modern Tel Aviv. But the problem was, some other people wanted that land too. So, see, it still goes on in ancient times and today. In those days, the problem was with the Philistines. And so the Philistines put pressure on the tribe of Dan when they attempted to settle in their coastal area that had been assigned to them by Joshua. So they said, this is not good. We are not prospering here. We should look around for another location. So the book of Judges tells about how they sent scouts out looking for a location, and they came to this place. And they said, well, this is a well-watered place. It's a very peaceful, kind of hidden away type of place. And so this would be a good place for us to live. And so the tribe of Dan moved up here and took over the old Canaanite city. The Canaanite city appears as early as Genesis 14. Yesterday we talked about Abraham going in pursuit of the kings from the east. And the kings from the east came west, and they marched down and conquered the people of Sodom and Gomorrah and took them and their spoils back. And Abraham received news, and he went in pursuit. And he and his Hittite friends and their troops caught up with him at a place called Laish. Laish. And that's the ancient Canaanite name of Dan. So Dan received the name of Dan when the tribe of Dan moved to Dan. But before that, it was known as Laish. Now we have this change of names in the Bible in several places. For instance, the city of Hebron. There's a text that says, well, they went up to Hebron, which formerly was known as Kiriath Arba. And so the Canaanites called it Kiriath Arba, and the Israelites who settled there later called it Hebron. And that, as you know, is a point of difficulty today also. So we're going to start at Tel Dan, and as you move south, you basically come down a central mountain ridge. And Brother Bevan was showing me out in the hall his atlas of the Bible, and it's a very beautiful one and very nicely arranged. But it demonstrates the four zones. There are four zones. You start with a coastal plain. Then you get to the lowlands, or the Shephelah, as it's called in the Bible, which is really the foothills. And then you go up to about 3,000 feet. That's the altitude of Jerusalem. Then you drop down on the eastern slope, and that eastern slope is called the Wilderness of Judea. And the reason it's called the Wilderness of Judea is because it rains very, very little there. The prevailing winds are westerlies, and they bring the rain in from the Mediterranean, and the rain falls on the western slopes. And so not very much of the rain gets back over to the other side. And that's why the eastern slope of that central ridge of Israel is so barren and so dry. And that was the area, the wilderness of Judea, into which Jesus went to be tempted. Where he fasted for 40 days and was tempted of the devil in that area. And that wilderness of Judea slopes down into the Jordan Valley. And already, by the time you get to the Sea of Galilee in the north, you are already 600 feet below sea level. And the Jordan River runs, it's called the more circuitous river in the world. I don't know if that's true, but it sure looks like it when you look at it in an aerial photograph. And it drops another 600 feet in 30 or 40 miles or so to come to the surface of the Dead Sea, which is 1,200 feet below sea level. And then it's easy to remember these 12s because it's 1,200 feet deep. The surface is 1,200 feet below sea level, and the bottom of the sea is another 1,200 feet down. So that's the Jordan Valley. And then there's the Jordanian Plateau, which is farther to the east. Now, water, as you know, is a very crucial thing in the Middle East. They say that there's one thing that a Bedouin will never refuse you in the desert, and that's water. And so water is what keeps things alive and what makes things grow. And so water has become an issue between the country of Israel and the country of Jordan. And the reason for that is the rainfall in Jordan is in part dependent upon evaporation from the Jordan Valley. Evaporation from the Jordan River, which comes down as rainfall. But the Israelis have been lowering the pumping water out of the Sea of Galilee for agriculture, and therefore the water level is down and the rainfall is down in Jordan. Now they have suggested a way in which they could adjust that. And so the Israelis have a long-range plan, who knows whether it will ever be realized or not, of cutting a tunnel up into the mountains from the Mediterranean, pumping water out of the Mediterranean, and then pumping water down into the Dead Sea, which would have the same effect of increasing the amount of evaporation and giving the rainfall in Jordan. And in addition, when the water is dropped down the pipe that declines down the eastern slope, they can generate electricity from it. So it's a possibility of resolving this tension over water between Israel and Jordan. And it's a serious problem. This solution may or may not work, and may, even if it does work, it probably would be a long-range project. But one place that has plenty of water is Dan. It's right at the foot of the slopes of Mount Hermon, and so the rivers that run off, the runoff from that mountain are very cool, refreshing pools and streams right there. And so when you take a group of hot, sweaty tourists to Tel Dan, and after they get through looking at around at the ruins there, then you can they have them dangle their feet in the pools of this icy, cool water. When the temperature is 100 degrees, you can't imagine anything that feels better than doing that. All right, so we'll start at Tel Dan in the north, and we'll go the direction of the arrow. And let's see, I got to get the right button here. If we could turn off the lights now. I guess there's a couple more to go. This is the entrance to the ancient city. The Israeli archaeologists who have excavated here have done a very nice job of building up and restoring these walls. The entrance, or the entryway, is actually down to your left, and you walk up to the right, and you go through a gate which goes on up the hill, which really in ancient times would be going into the city. And so these are the walls of Tel Dan as they originally stood about in the 8th or 9th century B.C., while the Israelites lived here. And there was an outer gate and an inner gate. We will see a little bit more of this. Here is more of the gate. And at the far right, you might see a little square of a room in there. And you see the gates of ancient cities were the weakest part of the city's defenses, because that's where you had an opening in the wall, of course. The walls are strong, but the opening in the wall is weak. And so when an enemy would attack, they would attack at the gate of the city. In order to build up the gate and make it stronger, they had several entryways to the gate. And so the gate complex was a very large fortified complex, in which they would have two or three entryways. Now the wooden doors are no longer there. And so all you see is the stumps of the stone walls that were part of the city gate. And a little farther up the hill is the second inner gate, and the Israeli archaeologists have restored this to an even greater height. That's 8 or 10 feet at least. And so you can see the defenses of this city were fairly secure. Now this as you go up through that gate, and you keep going, walking straight, you're walking to the northeast. You're walking in the direction of Mount Hermon. And so as you come to that northeast corner of this ancient city, this is what you find. This is what the archaeologists have uncovered. And what there is here, you'll see the steel frame on the left. Now the archaeologists didn't uncover a steel frame. They uncovered part of an altar. And the steel frame has been placed here to show you the dimensions of the altar. And then you see the steps to the right. In fact, there's somebody walking up those steps in the picture. And then up above there, there's a platform. And this is the religious installation of Tel Dan. And it's rather interesting. It has direct biblical connections because it has to do with a king named Jeroboam. Now, the story of the breakup of the kingdom is that Solomon lived and reigned for 40, or he lived a long time, 70 years, I guess, but he reigned for 40 years. And at the end of his reign, when he died, his son Rehoboam took over. And Rehoboam was the king in the south. But Rehoboam was still king of Israel. But the people of Israel gathered at a place called Shechem. We'll look at Shechem tomorrow, probably. And they said, "The burdens which your father have placed upon us are too heavy for us to bear. Lighten our burdens." Rehoboam listened to his advisors, and they said, "No, make them heavier." And so the northern kingdom, the 10 northern tribes, rose up in rebellion, placed their own king on their own throne, and that was Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam had a problem. And his problem was that the people would naturally and normally go down to Jerusalem to celebrate the festivals. And that means that a sizable portion of his population is going to be migrating back and forth across this border down to the southern kingdom. And some of them, when they get down there, they might see things are a little better, a little nicer, or a little more religiously verifiable, and he might lose some support. So he got the idea of building an alternate temple. Not exactly a temple, but an open-air platform. And on that open-air platform, he put a golden calf. And he put another golden calf at the other end of his kingdom. So he had one golden calf in a temple at Bethel, and he had another golden calf in the open-air space of Tel Dan. And this is the religious installation. And so probably that golden calf, which has not been found by the archaeologist, would have been located on the platform, the raised platform, which you see up to the right. In all probability, that was the location where Jeroboam put his golden calf for the worship of the Israelites. Now what you see in front of it, where you see the steel frame, they found part of the altar there. And if you look real carefully, you might see that the archaeologists have even been kind enough to put the horns on the steel frame. At each corner, there is a horn. It's a little curlicue, if you please. And so this is what the horns on the biblical altars look like. And we have some examples. In fact, I'll show you some examples later. But this is a very large, one might even call it massive, altar. In fact, there were steps up to this altar originally. And this is the altar upon which sacrifice was offered. The sacrifice of the burnt offering was offered here in Tel Dan on this altar as a substitute for the altar of burnt offering in Jerusalem, which belongs now to the southern kingdom. And so Jeroboam is making his religious sanctuary area right here at Tel Dan so that his subjects will not go south. And he also installed a substitute Passover. And the scriptures tell us about the substitute Passover and the golden calf that he put up here at Dan. Now this is very difficult to figure this out, but if you study it a little while, you'll see that the back wall here, well, first of all, let's start at the bottom. There are some steps going up. Can you see those steps? All right, those steps lead up to a little slot, a little vertical slot at the top of the steps. And around that, in mud bricks, is an arch. The complete arch is present here. Now, this is not Israelite. This is Canaanite. It's Canaanite, and it belongs to the period of about 1800 B.C. down to 1500 B.C., and this is the only place in the Holy Land where you will find a complete arch intact as it was 3,500 years ago. And when the archaeologists cleared all this, they found this marvelous arch. And if you could look at it up close, you would see it's made out of mud bricks. It's not stone. It's not limestone, which was the common building material. It's mud bricks. And so the mud bricks fan out and make the arch. Now, this is rather delicate, you know, number one from its age, number two from the material out of which it's made, because if you take mud bricks and you expose them to the elements, again, eventually they just go into powder. And so the Israelis have put this big carp tent over it to attempt to protect it from the elements. You know, as long as it was buried in the ground, it was kind of safe, but once you open it up, you expose it not only to tourists to look at, but you also expose it to the elements and the ravages of the elements. So this is a Middle Bronze Age, Canaanite, arched entryway to the ancient city of Dan. Now here that you've walked around that hot and dusty tell, that hot and dusty ruin mound, now you want to cool off. And here are the refreshing pools right by Tel Dan, that you can dang your feet in or wade in or drink the water or whatever. It's a nice melted snow water down out of the mountains. We're moving south, a little ways south, actually to the north end of the Sea of Galilee. And there you find an ancient site known as Hazor or Hazor. And it shows up in many places in the Bible, but in particular in 1 Kings 9, where it says Solomon built Hazor as one of his provincial administration centers. Basically, that's what it's saying there. And here you see the double wall on the... This is one of the largest ancient cities in all of Palestine. In Canaanite times, it was 140 acres. Now, that 140 acres was divided between 20 acres in the upper city, what we might call the Acropolis, and 120 acres in the lower city that was enclosed by a beaten earth embankment. And you'll see a double wall here. Here's one line of the wall, and there's another line of the wall. These double walls were fairly common in ancient times. They have a name for them. They're called casemate walls. And these walls serve several purposes. For one thing, there are rooms in the walls. In fact, you can see there's a room at the bottom, there's a room partway up, and there's two more rooms on beyond. Those people sometimes lived in those rooms. In addition, they were used for things like storage. And then when war would come, they would sometimes fill these rooms in, and that would thicken and make the wall stronger to protect your defenses against the enemy. So this is the Acropolis of Hazor, and this is a view up on top of the mound, looking to the hills of Galilee to the west. As you go up the western side of the country of Israel, you come to low mountains first. That's called Lower Galilee. And then you go up to higher mountains, and that's called Upper Galilee. So Upper Galilee is some of the taller mountains in Israel. Now here's some more of Hazor. And this is an area which was used for storage rooms. And let me go ahead and see if I have another view of it. Well, we've gone on to the waterworks. Very interesting story of this. The man who excavated this place was Yigal Yadin. Yigal Yadin was a very famous man. He was a very versatile man. He was a general in the Israeli army. He was an assistant to the prime minister, and he was a professional archaeologist, all wrapped into one man. He long had the theory that about the middle of the upper part of the city was where the waterworks were. Now, waterworks, of course, I mentioned the importance of water in the Middle East, the importance of water in these ancient cities. And another aspect of that water is you needed to protect it. You needed to protect the water supply of the city. Because if an enemy came and cut you off from your water supply, you're done for. And so what they did is they cut down through the rock, and they cut down sometimes 75 to 100 feet down to the water table. And so what you see here, the red pipes are, of course, put there by modern archaeologists, but the red pipes and the stairs follow the ancient stairs. And the ancient stairs went down in a square, on down, 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 deep into this ancient city. Now, the way Professor Yadin found this was rather unorthodox. As he looked at this upper city, he said, look, in the middle of it, there's a little depression. I'll bet that's where the water supply was. Now, of course, a normal archaeologist would take a whole crew of workmen and start digging here. Not Professor Yadin. He brought in a backhoe. He brought in a backhoe and started digging in this depression and took it down and found, indeed, he hit it. He found the water supply. Now, of course, if he hadn't found it, his name would have been Mud. But he found it. So, you know, so he's a genius. You know, so this is the ancient water supply of the city of Hazor and illustrates the great lengths, the great engineering lengths that the people would go to protect their water supply. We've moved a little farther south to the south end of the Sea of Galilee. We're progressing south. Dan, Hazor, this is Beth-Chan. And Bethshan is mentioned in the Bible in particular in terms of the story of the death of Saul and Jonathan. And there was a battle fought right nearby here. And after the battle was over, Saul and Jonathan had died in the battle. And the Philistines, whom they had been fighting, brought the heads of Saul and Jonathan and hung them on the walls of this city, Bethshan. Now, what you see here is not from the time of Saul and Jonathan. What you see here is from the time of the Romans. And so you see a street which goes through the middle, and on each side of the street you can see the remains of the walls of shops, and a little bit more of remains of shops to the left, and farther in the back you'll see a Roman amphitheater at the upper left. You may see kind of a curlicue or curved semicircular structure there. That's an amphitheater. It's been restored. It was found in a rather broken down condition, and they use it during some seasons for things like concerts and so forth. They have a bigger example of a Roman amphitheater down at the coast of Israel in the town of Caesarea, which was the Roman capital of Palestine, and also the place from which Paul sailed when he sailed to Rome. So here's Roman Bethshan. And here's the street. And you see the columns which stand in front of the stores, the shops, the merchant shops. On the left-hand side, right immediately in front of you, was the temple of the god of Bethshan. Now remember, the Roman settlers here were not monotheistic Israelites. They were Roman pagans, polytheists, and worshipped various gods. And you'll see how the columns of this temple have fallen, and that is attributable to a datable earthquake. And it occurred about 750 AD. And so this was when the pagan temple of Bethshan was finally destroyed. Here's the amphitheater up close. You can see how nicely it's been restored, and you can see how they could easily use it for modern programs today, concerts and so forth. Concerts, plays, what have you. And this is standing in the tunnel of the amphitheater, looking on the Roman city down below, and looking at what's on the horizon in the picture is the Canaanite city of Bethshan. So it would have been on the wall of that upper mound of the ancient city where the heads of Saul and Jonathan would have been hung. Here's another look at it. And you can see it's really quite a climb. And you can see there are, some tents up there, because when we visited there in July of last year, there were excavations being carried on by, I think, a French group. And so the group that I was traveling with were suggesting that maybe the poor little tree that's standing off to the left, maybe that's where their heads were hung. But actually, there would have been a city wall on that upper mound. The city wall has fallen down in decay and so forth. And so that would have been the area in which the heads would have been hung. This, of course, was a method of demonstrating the disgrace that had come upon the Israelite soldiers who had lost to the Philistines. This is the Sea of Galilee itself. It's fairly large. You can take boat rides across it. You can take boat rides across it from Tiberias at the south end to the town of Capernaum, which is on the west side of the Sea of Galilee. And this is the baptismal area. If you want to be baptized in the Jordan River, you can do that. It used to be that people would baptize any place up and down the river that they wanted to, and the Israeli government didn't like that very well. So what they did was they built an installation. And this installation is right at the outlet of the Sea of Galilee, where the Jordan River takes off down into the Jordan Valley. And they have built a very nice baptismal area. You can see the walkway, the little white picket there, where the baptismal candidates can line up as they come down to the water. So the two gentlemen in the water are actually two Adventist ministers. And so they baptized each other. And they did this not as a real full-fledged baptism, but as a rededication to their ministerial task. This is Capernaum. And Capernaum is located about the middle of the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. It was famous in New Testament times, in particular as the home of Peter. And indeed, some of the Catholic scholars believe that they have found Peter's house or Peter's mother's house there. That's somewhat questionable, but what we do know about it is that there is a synagogue there, and there are two distinct levels to this synagogue. This is what is called the White Synagogue, and this is the kind of the speaker's end of the synagogue, and the columns are still there. This probably dates to about the 4th century A.D., Underneath it is what is called the Black Synagogue, another level of the synagogue. And the Black Synagogue is thought to go back to the 2nd century A.D. or possibly the 1st century A.D., to the time of Jesus. Thank you. I seem to be a little hoarse today. Appreciate that. So this is the synagogue, and remember Jesus went into this synagogue, and this is where he read the scriptures. And here are some more. These are the houses adjacent to this synagogue. And you can see the black stone that is used in these walls. That is not limestone, that's basalt. This area around the Sea of Galilee is a volcanic, was in ancient times or prehistoric times, a volcanic area, and this black basalt stone is characteristic of this volcanic area in the northeastern part of Israel. Not too far away is the city of Nazareth. And there really isn't very much to see there unless you like churches. There aren't really any ancient historic ruins. So what you see are churches. And as you might expect, as happens in the Holy Land, one church will build a church in one place and say, this is where such and such happened. And then another church will build one in another place nearby and say, no, this is where it happened. So when you come to Jerusalem, there are actually four gardens of Gethsemane. There's the Roman Catholic Garden of Gethsemane. There's the Russian Orthodox Garden of Gethsemane. There's the Greek Orthodox Garden of Gethsemane. And I forget which church has the fourth one. The nicest one is the Roman Catholic Garden of Gethsemane because they have the oldest share of olive trees. But at any rate, this is the Orthodox Church of the Annunciation of Mary, where Mary is supposed to have received the Annunciation that she would be the mother to the Messiah. And this is the Roman Catholic Church, which is located about 4 or 5 blocks away. And this is the church also dedicated. This is the grotto where in the center of this big church, it's it was a church which was built with donations from countries all around the world. And it has been recently remodeled over a period of about a decade and is now open for use in this newer form. This is the grotto down in the center of it, and Mary is supposed to have functioned in this area when she lived here in the first century. As I say, there's not too much. All you see is traditional church sites in Nazareth, so it's worthwhile seeing, but not direct archaeological historical material. Now, this is the Jezreel Valley. The Jezreel Valley starts at the southern corner of the Sea of Galilee, or also where Bethshan was located. And the Jezreel Valley takes off to the northwest, and it goes out to the Bay of Haifa. And in the Jezreel Valley, there are a number of interesting archaeological sites, and this is probably the most famous one. This is Megiddo. And this is my wife walking up the trail. She looks rather hot and tired, and I guess by that time of day, late in the afternoon, it was. And so you see some of the ruins of Megiddo nearby. This is the cistern, or the waterworks, of Megiddo. This was found by the University of Chicago back in the 1930s, and it's very much like the waterworks that we saw at Hazor are kind of square. This one is a round cistern-like thing with steps. And this is the water tunnel. They have it all open to tourists, and they have it lighted up. And so you get down to a certain level, and then the tunnel goes horizontally till you get to the water supply at the end, just inside the wall of the city. So the women, of course, were the ones who had to draw the water. And so the women would carry the jars on their heads, probably, and they would go down the stairs. And then at the bottom of the stairs, they would go the length of the tunnel. Then they would get to the bottom. They would dip their jugs in the water, and then they would carry it all the way back up to the houses. And so this was the work of using water for various purposes in the houses, and this is how you got it, and this is how they protected it. And this is the exit. You see they have the tour of Megiddo is laid out in such a way that you walk through the ancient city, then you walk down through the waterworks, and then you walk out, and as you come out of the waterworks, this is the exit. Before I move on, let me talk a little bit about Megiddo, because there's very interesting stories about Megiddo. Megiddo plays a place in Advent, even in Adventist history, not just interpretation of Armageddon, but there was a pharaoh in Egypt. His name was Thutmose III. He lived in the 15th century B.C., and Egypt at that time owned the land of Canaan. But the Canaanites got the idea that they would rebel against Pharaoh, so they did, and he marched north with his army to subdue the Canaanites. He came to a place just south of the Mount Carmel Range. And the Mount Carmel Range runs along the south side of the Jezreel Valley. He encamped there for the night. The Canaanites were centered in Megiddo on the other side of the hill. And so there is an inscription on the great Karnak Temple in Egypt which tells about this military campaign. And so the Pharaoh gets his generals together and says, now look, there's three ways that we can get into that valley. We can go around the west end, we can go around the east end, or we can march straight through the Aruna Pass. What do you think we should do? So some of the generals said, well, let's go around the west end. Another general said, let's go around the east end. And then Thutmose says, no, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to march right through the Aruna Pass. And they made a forced march by night. They broke out into the Jezreel Valley early in the morning and caught the Canaanites napping and conquered and defeated them. Now, there is a name in the Bible, Har-Megiddon, Armageddon, we call it. And it means, when you break the two parts of that word about, the mountain of Megiddo. And so, early Adventist preachers, up until World War I, were firmly of the belief that there would be a literal Armageddon fought in the Holy Land at this site. And believe it or not, it actually happened. There was a battle of Armageddon, or Megiddo, fought in World War I. The British Army, under General Allenby, was marching north through the Plain of Sharon. And he came and encamped at a certain place. And he faced the same problem that Thutmose III had 3,500 years earlier. Now, General Allenby, as a student, as a young lieutenant, had attended Sandhurst, the British Military Academy. And one of their assignments in Sandhurst was to study famous battles of ancient history and what was the strategy used. And General Allenby, in his student days, had studied the battle of Thutmose III at Megiddo. And so he finds himself with the British Expeditionary Force in the same place where Thutmose III was 3,500 years ago. And knowing his knowledge of how it happened, he did exactly the same thing. He took his troops and he marched straight through the Aruna Pass, surprised the Turks, who then held Palestine, and defeated them. And the Adventists at the General Conference in Tacoma Park were watching the ticker tapes, because this is the fighting of the battle of Armageddon that they'd been preaching about. And then they expected that Jesus would come. But he didn't come. And they sat down and puzzled about it. In fact, they puzzled about it in a rather formal way at something called the 1919 Bible Conference. There were two questions at the 1919 Bible Conference. One was, what will the church now do now that the prophetess is dead? And the other question was what was called in those days the Eastern Question. What direction will we take now with our preaching on Armageddon when the Battle of Armageddon was fought and Christ didn't come? And so then it was they began to realize or look more carefully at the text of Revelation about there's really more symbolism here than they had anticipated previously. Now you will read Bible commentaries that will say there is no Harmageddon. There's no mountain of Megiddo. Well, I took my tour group there last summer, and you stand on Megiddo and you turn to the south and you look at a range of mountains. And that range of mountains is called Mount Carmel. And there was a battle fought on Mount Carmel. And the imagery from the battle fought on Mount Carmel has been taken over in the book of Revelation and used for the battle that will be fought at the end of time. Now, what was the battle fought in ancient times? Elijah against who? The prophets of Baal, the false prophets. And so when you come to the book of Revelation, the unholy trinity in the last times are the dragon, the beast, and the what? False prophet. And they gather, they prepare by gathering at a spiritual place of Mount Carmel to do battle with the true prophets of God, the true Son of God, the true prophet of God. So, a restudy of this issue leads more to what I would call understanding Megiddo as a symbol. And it's a symbol of the last great battle of earth. Now, notice carefully when you read the book of Revelation, the battle of Armageddon is not fought in Revelation chapter 16. It's the preparations for the battle. The battle is actually fought in Revelation 19, when Christ rides forth from heaven as King of Kings and Lord of Lords on his white charger with the forces, the host of heaven behind him. And then he comes and confronts who? The dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. And he defeats them and vanquishes them. So the preparation for the battle is in Revelation chapter 16, but the battle itself is actually fought in Revelation 19. There's the battle of Armageddon. It has another name. It's called the Battle of the Great Day of the Lord God Almighty. And so that's the real Battle of Armageddon. All right, we've moved on to Caesarea. Caesarea, it was the Roman capital of Palestine, and you can see they had an amphitheater here, and this is the actual size of the original amphitheater. It has been repaired. Of course, it's fallen down through time. And so you also have concerts of the Israel Philharmonic and visiting Philharmonic orchestras that perform there. The day we were there, they had the lights up for a rock concert the next night. So you get all kinds. And here is some of the reconstruction work still being done and some of the framework that was being put up for the concert that was going to come. This is the coast right at Caesarea. And if you look in the right upper corner, there's a quay or a harbor that extends out to the right there. And Herod the Great had this harbor built and expanded. Archaeologists are even doing underwater archaeology to study how he built this harbor. So it was out of this harbor that Paul sailed for Rome. And it is at Caesarea that an inscription from Pontius Pilate has been found. There is a duplicate of the inscription still there, but the original has been taken to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And it mentions his name quite clearly in his title and something about a date, giving demonstration and evidence of the fact that he was governor, Roman procurator in the province of Judea, And his reign as governor, as procurator, lasted about 10 years, from about 26 to about 36. This is another view of Caesarea. The ruins down in front are from Byzantine times. This city has a long history, and it's a very, very large city. It covers several square miles. And they'll never be able to excavate all of it. But there is also a very large Crusader fort there. When the Crusaders came here in about the year 1100, they had the established Crusader kingdoms for 150 years until about 1250, and they were finally rooted out by the Muslims. This is my little tour group, and it's of interest because the lady in the white hat with the blue striped shirt was from Loma Linda University, and she was digging there during the summer, and so she was explaining to us what they had found. This again is the harbor, and you can have a nice swim there too. Also pleasant and refreshing. Now we've gone up to Jerusalem, and what you're looking at on the left-hand side is the Mount of Olives. You're looking really at the east end of the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives really has three peaks. And as it is a kind of a mountain ridge. And so this is the east central portion. And so the more biblical part of events is really a little farther in the other direction. This is the western wall, as they prefer to call it today. Sometimes you may have called it the Wailing Wall. This is the retaining wall. It's the retaining wall of the temple area. In other words, to keep that the structures up on top in the great temple area, to keep them intact, you needed a retaining wall all the way around this area, which takes in, I don't remember the exact measurements, let's say 15 acres are inside this retaining wall, and this is the most prominent, readily available portion of it. And as you can see, it is used for Jewish religious worship services. And so a nice thing to do if you're in Jerusalem, you go here on Friday evening at sundown and they have their worship services and you can stand back and watch what's going on. Now, of course, you have to be a little careful about segregation because the ladies go to the right and the men go to the left and never the twain shall meet. Here's my daughter and with the Wailing Wall in the background, and the particular note of interest is she was wearing shorts as we were walking around here, and the religious Orthodox don't like ladies' uncovered legs, so they give you a little wraparound skirt. So she has this little green wraparound skirt that was given to her by one of the people at the entryway, and then you discard it when you go out the door on the other, the gate on the other side. This is the Pool of Bethesda. It is the site of the miracle in John 5. And the pools, so you can see, they are quite a long ways down. Now, there's not much water in them. There is some water in some of the pools. There is a water table there. This is on the grounds of the Church of St. Anne, right at the east northeast gate of Jerusalem. These pools, which you're looking at right here, probably date to about the 4th century A.D., There is one pool that is far all the way at the west end, which is thought to possibly go back to the 1st century A.D. But when you think of Jesus passing by here, there's a couple of things you might think about. Number one, you'll see how history piles up dirt. And so you're standing on the living level today. The living level in ancient times was down where these columns, the base of these columns and pillars. And so Jesus was on his way either from the temple or to the temple. This is right at the corner of the temple area. And as he passed by, he saw this particularly miserable man, a paralytic who had been that way for much of his life. And so Jesus speaks to him. And of course, there was the local tradition at the time that when the waters bubbled, if you got in there first, you'd be healed. Probably there's a subterranean pool that bubbles this water up into the pools. Probably is what happened. So the man thinks that Jesus is going to carry him over to the pool. But Jesus says, no, take up your bed and walk. It's the spoken word of the Creator recreates this man's body. This is more looking down at some of the pools. You can see it's a long ways down, which shows you the distance between modern times and Roman times. And as I mentioned, most of the pools are today dry. And as you can see, it's a series or a complex of pools. Well, we've come to Jerusalem. And this is ancient Jerusalem of Nebuchadnezzar's time. This is a large retaining wall which was built here in the 7th, 6th century time. And at the base of this, there is the burnt out fragments of the city of Jerusalem that Nebuchadnezzar left behind in his wake of destruction. And so the retaining wall that they had built there was not successful in fending off or defending against the enemy that came in from the outside. And if you keep going down the hill, you'll come to the Hezekiah's water tunnel. And this is the upper entrance, the eastern entrance of Hezekiah's water tunnel. And there's our fearless leader with the little white hat on. That's me. And this tunnel goes 1,700 feet through the rock hill of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a city that's built on four hills: northwest, northeast, southeast, and southwest. And this southeast hill, called Mount Ophel in the Bible, is the place where the most ancient portion of the city of Jerusalem was located. It's where the Jebusites lived in David's time when he conquered the city. And Hezekiah knew that the Assyrians were coming, and I've already showed you two other cities where they showed how they wanted to protect their water supply. So Hezekiah wanted to protect the water supply of Jerusalem against the Assyrians, and so he cut this tunnel through the rock at the base or foot of the mountain of the southeast hill of Jerusalem, and it empties out into the Pool of Siloam, which was the other pool at which Jesus performed a Sabbath miracle in the Gospel of John. And so here are our intrepid hikers coming out at the other end. This is the Pool of Siloam. This is the Pool of Siloam essentially as it was in the first century. Of course, it's undergone repairs, but this is the exit of the tunnel where the water comes through. You can walk through that tunnel, as I showed you the people going in. You have to, sometimes it's about 5 feet high. Sometimes you have to bend over. The water is up to your mid-thigh, and the rocks underneath are kind of slippery, so you need to wear some tennis shoes or something like that. But you can walk all the way through, and you just take a flashlight so you can see where you're going. And there was an inscription which was found at the exit or mouth of the Pool of Siloam. It was an inscription which was written in the time of King Hezekiah, and it celebrated the completion of the construction. And the construction worked with two teams. Let me put this down for a minute so I can... There was a northern team and there was a southern team. And the two teams were tunneling through the rock hill of Mount Ophel. And as they came close, the inscription tells about how they could hear the other team. The adds, the rock, that they used to cut the rock, the team was coming from the south and the team was coming from the north. And the sounds would reverberate through the rock. And so when they got close, they could hear the other team. And then when they met, and then they broke it open, then the water rushes through. Because the spring, the Gihon spring at the upper end, supplied the water that filled the tunnel and filled the Pool of Siloam. And so this inscription was found by two little boys who, one of whom was the son of an American family that ran the American Colony Hotel. And the other was a little Arab boy whom they had adopted. This happened back in the 1880s, and the Turks governed this country at that time, so the inscription was chiseled out and taken to Istanbul. So if you want to see the inscription that was found at the exit of this tunnel and pool, you have to go to Istanbul in Turkey, not to Jerusalem. The Israelis, of course, have appealed for them to give it back on any number of occasions, but they don't seem to be willing to do so. So this is Hezekiah's water tunnel. It's mentioned in the book of Kings. It's mentioned in the book of Chronicles. And it was cut as a protection to defend the city's water supply against the Assyrian army of Sennacherib. And the story of Sennacherib's attack is described in 2 Kings 18 and 19. Well, I mentioned that there are four different gardens of Gethsemane, and here's the best one. This is the Roman Catholic Garden of Gethsemane. And you can see the big, thick trunks of these olive trees. And so the question is, do these olive trees go back to the time of Jesus? My guess is probably not. They probably go back 800 to 1,000 years. They are very, very old trees. They're still alive. But the story of the conquest of Jerusalem by the Roman army is that they stripped all the wood off the hills to use in the siege of the city. So if there were olive trees standing there, the Roman troops probably cut them down and used them to attack the city. So these would have been some new growth sometime later after that time. But they do give you a very nice idea of what the olive trees that would have been on the slope of that hill would have been like. This is the Rockefeller Museum. You know the Rockefeller family here in the United States, very famous, very wealthy, going back to John D. Rockefeller, who made his money in oil. And in the later part of his life, he kind of atoned for his sins by contributing to various philanthropic projects. And he offered each one of the countries in the Middle East to build them a museum. The only country that took him up on it was the Palestine Mandate of the British. And so this museum was built by Rockefeller funds in the 1930s. It became the location where the Dead Sea Scrolls were taken when Jerusalem was a divided city before the 1967 war. And so this was one of the targets as the Israeli troops attacked the old city of Jerusalem. And if we could see real close, you might see that there are still chips around the windows where machine gun bullets chipped out the rock as the battle for this part of the city went on. That was the 1967 war. When the Israelis conquered it, they took the Dead Sea Scrolls out of this museum and moved them to the western part of the city to the Shrine of the Book. Shrine of the Book, which is the current museum where they are stored. This is a tower on a church. And to be honest with you, I've forgotten which church this is. There's so many around Jerusalem, but you know, you can say, well, you've seen a church in Jerusalem. I think it's the Church of the Ascension, which is up on the Mount of Olives, but that's not vital. Now we are in Bethlehem. Okay, let me go back and show you the church in Bethlehem. Scratch that. This is the bell tower of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. And there are some interesting stories about this church. This is the oldest standing church in Christendom. It was built in the year 321 on the order of Emperor Constantine and his mother Helena. They visited the Holy Land at that time, and they went around looking for the spots where the stories of the Gospels and other events happened. And so when they came to Bethlehem, they had this church built here because they were told that this was the probable traditional place where Jesus was born. Now, many of the other churches were built at that time, but they were all destroyed. There was a Persian king in the early 7th century. His name was Khosroes II, and he marched west, and he destroyed the Christian churches all over Palestine. But when his soldiers came to this church, they saw a mural, a painting on the wall. And the painting was of the three wise men who had come from the east to come to visit the baby Jesus. And the three wise men from the east were dressed in Persian-style clothes. So he said, "Leave this church. Don't burn it down." So this church has survived to this day. Now, it has had fires, it's had earthquakes, it's been rebuilt and patched up. But by and large, this building has survived from the year 321 to the present. It's the oldest church in Christendom. Now, here's how you get in the church. You know, you think of cathedrals with these great open doors. Well, the problem is, when the Muslims took over in the 7th century, they used to run their horses in the square out here, and they used to run their horses right into the church. And so the Christian fathers didn't like that very well, so they narrowed the door down so the horses couldn't get into the church anymore. So this narrow entrance was built to keep out Muslim horsemen. This is also a very famous place for the translation of the Bible. This is a statue. The man on the top of the statue is a man named Jerome. Jerome was the translator of the Vulgate, the Latin version of the Bible. And Jerome, as a good conscientious translator, went to the Holy Land to live there. He lived out the rest of his life here, and he spent many years talking to the rabbis about the Hebrew of the Hebrew Bible and facilitate his accurate translation of the Vulgate. So he lived in the monastery here at this church. So the statue represents a man who lived here in the 5th century and made his contribution to biblical literature that remained famous for all time. And of course you know some of the stories about places where he got a little mistranslation. In fact, Martin Luther stumbled over one of his mistranslations in Romans 1 until he finally got to the Greek original. And so this is Jerome, translator at the Vulgate. Here's the inside of the church, and when we were there, there was a group of nuns from, I think, France or Belgium. And they're standing in front of the grotto, which is at the far end of the church, and the grotto leads down into a little narrow cavity. And so some question has been raised, could this possibly be original? Could the traditional site... It has a possibility. Now, many of the traditional sites you can dismiss. But this one was a cave. It was located at the east end of the main street of Bethlehem. And people commonly placed their animals in caves. They used the caves for animal pens. And so Ellen White even talks about how the parents of Jesus took the long walk, donkey ride, down the length of the street of Bethlehem till they came to the place. And so this is at the end of that street. It's a cave. Could have been used for animals. And so there's some possibility that the original tradition may be accurate. Might be one of the cases where it is accurate. Well, this is the scene of a very famous discovery, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls are basically copies of the Hebrew Bible that go back 1,000 years earlier than any copies of the Hebrew Bible that we had before. This discovery was made in the year 1947. In 1946, up till 1946, the oldest copy of the Hebrew Bible, I'm not speaking about the Greek Bible, that's a different story, or the Greek Old Testament. I'm speaking about the Hebrew Bible, the oldest copy of the Hebrew Bible until 1946, dated to 895 A.D. With this discovery from these caves, then our knowledge of the Hebrew Scriptures goes back another 1,000 years because there are biblical fragments and texts which come from the 2nd century B.C. and the 1st century B.C., and in addition, the 1st century A.D. Many of these are little bits and pieces. They stored these scrolls. These scrolls were written by some monks who lived at a monastery at the foot of these hills. It's called Qumran. And the people who lived in that monastery were of the Essene Jewish sect. And they had been priests. They had been kicked out of Jerusalem by the ruling party about 100 B.C., so they moved down here to the desert, founded this monastery, lived there, and carried on their writings. They copied biblical scrolls, and they also wrote their own sectarian documents. And so the current argument over the Dead Sea Scrolls is not about the biblical texts. Most of them have been published, and they were a disappointment to scholars. Why? because they didn't show enough differences with the texts that we already had. So the biblical scrolls, by and large, with one or two exceptions, were a disappointment because what they really showed was the accurate transmission of the Bible. Over a period of 1,000 years, the book of Isaiah in the Aleppo Codex, as it's called, the Codex Ben Asher, is the same as the book of Isaiah here. Now, it so happens, you know, we're dealt the accident of discovery or the accident of preservation. The longest scroll found here, the longest biblical scroll, is 26 feet long, and that is the complete scroll of the book of Isaiah. There's another copy of the book of Isaiah that has about two-thirds of the book. Now, if we looked at the handwriting of all you people, probably we'd find somebody who would write very neatly and somebody who would write rather sloppily with big curved letters. And that's the way ancient scribes work too. So the paradox is, the scribe who wrote the full, copied, the full complete scroll of Isaiah, he was not a very neat or accurate scribe. The scribe who wrote the copy of the book of Isaiah that we have, that about two-thirds of the book, was a very neat and very careful scribe. Now, when I'm talking about mistakes, what do I mean? I mean misspelling of words, or dropping a word out, or adding an extra word in. And they actually went back, as they reread the scroll, they put the corrections in. They put the corrections when they'd made a scribal error. He'd miscopied something. They put the correction in later as they went back over the scroll. So by accident, we get two great copies of the book of Isaiah. But cave 4, this is cave 4. There were 12 caves out of which these scrolls came. Cave 4, the jars had fallen, broken, and the rodents of the desert came in, and they liked leather. You know, that's what these scrolls basically were. They chewed it all up. So there were 10,000 pieces or fragments of biblical scrolls that came out of this one cave. They were taken to the Rockefeller Museum, where they were put under glass, and for years and years, scholars were sorting these. It's been called the world's greatest jigsaw puzzle. The fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls, 10,000 pieces of it that came from Cave 4. The story of the discovery, I'm sure you've probably heard. There was a shepherd boy, a goat herd actually. He had goats. And his name was Muhammad, as many people in the Middle East is their name, Muhammad the Wolf. And so he was out with his goats, and these goats were scrambling around on these hillsides, and he wanted to get them down. And so he started pelting them with stones to get the goats down off the hills. And when he tossed a stone up there, he heard a funny sound. He heard a clink. He said, "That's strange. That doesn't sound like it's hitting rock." So he climbed up there, climbed into this cave, and found that his stone had hit part of the pottery jars that in which the scrolls were stored. That's 1947, and that opened up all this new vista of biblical discoveries. So that's one nice thing about archaeology. You never know what will lie beyond the next shovel full of dirt. Maybe some magnificent discovery. This is the monastery where they worked. And I believe this room, I can't read it very well, but I think it's the scriptorium. It's the room in which they copied the scrolls. There were benches, stone benches, and there were also, they have found little inkwells. And the ink, the traces of ink in the inkwells match the iron content and so forth, the chemical content of the ink that is found on the scroll. So we know where they produce it. Now, one thing you have to do, of course, is swim in the Dead Sea. And of course, you can't swim in the Dead Sea because you can't sink or you can't get under the water. And you wouldn't want to get under the water because of the high content of salts. It'll burn your eyes if you get this water in your eyes, but you can float. You know, what you're supposed to do as a tourist, you're supposed to take a copy of the Jerusalem Post newspaper and you're supposed to float there reading the newspaper. You see, that's how you're supposed to have your picture taken. And this is the area of Qumran, the cliffs, actually the cliffs of Masada. The cliffs of Masada. You know very well the story of the conquest of Jerusalem in 70 AD. The war started, the Roman war started in 67. The Romans conquered Jerusalem in 70 AD, but that didn't finish the war because there were little holdout groups. Now this was a mountain fortress of Herod the Great, and the Roman soldiers had taken it over at one time. But a group of Jewish zealots took this area over. And I guess I don't have any more pictures of Masada. So they took over this mountain of Masada, and it's the central mountain peak. And as you take a tram, an aerial tramway up from the left to go up there, you don't have to climb and hike the trail, which earlier explorers did. But the Herod the Great had this as a mountain defense. You know, he was not a popular king, and he didn't know at any given moment when his subjects might rise up in rebellion. So he created several of these forts around the country for refuges to which he could repair in times of trouble. And so the Jewish zealots eventually took this place over from the Roman soldiers, and the Roman soldiers took 3 years after the fall of Jerusalem, from 70 to 73. They took 3 years to conquer this. And if you could look on the back side of the mountain, we're looking at the front side, you would see the ramp that runs up to the Roman ramp that they built little by little under fire. And they used prisoners sometimes to do this building. And that's the way they finally broke into the city. And when they broke into the city, they found out that everybody except two women and one or two children had committed suicide. All the warriors, all the Judean defense men who lived in the city had all committed suicide so that they would not fall into the hands of the Romans. The Israeli army uses that today. When you are inducted into the Israeli army, you are taken here to Masada. And you take the vow, Masada shall not fall again. That's the induction into the Israeli army, and they do it here at Masada as a pledge that what happened in 73 to the final holdouts against the Romans wouldn't happen again. There is another section of slides, but I'll save that for tomorrow. That's Jericho, and we'll fight the second battle of Jericho tomorrow, and some other things too. We have 5 minutes. Do we have any questions? We've kind of rambled across the countryside. Yes, in the back. On the ark. I'll talk about the ark tomorrow. I think I promised my Daniel class this morning that we'd talk about the ark tomorrow. To answer your question simply, the answer, not really. Still, I really want to talk more about the Ark of the Covenant, because there's been quite a bit of popularity of that subject in Adventist churches recently. And but I'll tell you what I do know about Noah's Ark in brief. And I try to, you know, the most common questions I'm ever asked about archaeology is, where is Noah's Ark and where is the Ark of the Covenant? So I'm prepared for you. We'll get to it tomorrow. Any other questions? Yes?
To one of the first churches, money was given by the world to build that church. Is there any reason why?
Well, they wanted to demonstrate the world support. That it's a communal, an international communal project. That's the church. They did that twice. They did that with the Church of All Nations, which is the Roman Catholic Church in the Garden of Gethsemane, and they also did that with the church at Nazareth. So you might be interested to know that the Muslims did the same thing. In the 1947 war, the Golden Dome of the Dome of the Rock was damaged by artillery fire, and so an offering was taken up in all of the Muslim countries of all the Middle East to repair the Golden Dome, and so you see it in its pristine condition there today. Any other questions? Yes?
It seems like on the slides we look at here, there's a lot of barren areas, and yet when we talk about the children of Israel going to this promised land, you expect a lot more plush area, the grapes as large as melons and things like
right.
that.
Right, yeah.
Is it because of the time frame of the wet time that you mentioned before?
It has to do with two factors. One is tourists, American tourists, usually go to the Middle East in summertime. If you go about March, when they have the Passover celebration, you will see these hills as green. The rains, the winter rains, finish about March. The rains start in November and they finish about March, and it leaves the hillsides green, at least on the western slope. The other factor is that over the centuries, the country was deforested. And so the runoff was very severe, and so the Israelis, as they expanded their part of the country, they have started in with a massive reforestation program. And so you will see, as you ride the bus up to Jerusalem, you'll see all kinds of forests around you. And that aim is not only to beautify the country, but also to prevent erosion from weathering and so forth. So the country has been badly treated over the ages. And we do have texts from ancient times. There's an Egyptian text from 2000 BC that tells about an Egyptian traveler that took a journey up through the land of Canaan. And he describes it in very biblical terms, the land of milk and honey and plush and fertile and so forth. So the weathering, the changes in climate have affected it, the erosion from cutting all the trees down, and then the time of year when tourists go there. So it's a combination of factors why it looks so barren. It's supposed to make you thirsty, so you'll head for the cafeteria to get your drinks. Any other questions? All right, we'll let you go to supper then. And one more. Okay.
You had mentioned the book of Maccabees.
Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay, the question is about the canon of the Bible, in particular the canon of the Old Testament. The books of the Old Testament that are in the canon, in the authorized Bible by the Hebrews, end about 400. That's the 420 BC, really. That's the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, Malachi. And so the book of Maccabees was written in the late 2nd century BC, so this is evident. The fact that it did not make it into the Hebrew canon is evidence that the Hebrews had already closed the canon of their scriptures before the time of Maccabees was written. Now, it has made it into the Catholic Bible. And so these are the apocryphal books. And, of course, this was a decision of the church later. But Paul says in Romans 9, that is there any advantage to being a Jew? And he says, yes, in many ways. In one, to them belong the scriptures and so on and so forth. So that means that the Jewish people themselves were the custodians of the scriptures and indeed the ones who canonized them. And since they canonized the Bible without the book of Maccabees being in it, we, the Protestant Bibles, don't use it. All right, I guess I really will let you go to supper now.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.